Here are three things I think you should know about today. Qatar is firm. It was not yet given a courtesy call or any kind of warning before being bombed yesterday. The U.S. has a very rich history and a recent record of lying and cheating on deals like this. And you know who says that? No, not me. I'm not saying that about my country. The ex-CIA director of the United States is saying that. You're going to hear it. And does Israel really want to deal with Hamas? Because it seems like that might just get in the way of what their real goal is. And we're going to talk about this with a Zionist who is a former IDF intel officer. This is the Sanchez Effect. Hey, let's do this. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know how you can spot someone when they're lying? When they're reading a statement, one that you can tell they themselves did not write. In fact, my experience as a journalist and as a business person will always tell me that that's exactly what is happening in this video that I'm about to show you. It's probably what always happens because what that person is in the moment reading usually is written by a team of either lawyers or public relations people. Here, judge for yourself.
President Trump immediately directed Special Envoy Witkoff to inform the Qataris of the impending attack, which he did. The president views Qatar as a strong ally and friend of the United States and feels very badly about the location of this attack. However, eliminating Hamas, who have profited off the misery of those living in Gaza, is a worthy goal.
The president has approved this because he has made a decision to... You see what I mean? I mean, by the way, can I just do this as an aside real quick for you? Because I want to get something off my chest. I want to share something with you that has always bothered me. That woman you just saw right there, her job title is White House Press Secretary. It's a role that was actually created by Abraham Lincoln so that the press could be kept informed about the Civil War by one of their own, right? It's always been a job for a journalist. Usually it was a reporter from the New York Times or some, you know, old dude like me who was retiring or close to retiring at the Washington Post or maybe even a news network in the past, right? Somebody who the other reporters in the room knew and trusted and could work with because they felt like that person was one of them. But in recent years, this job, starting, by the way, with Bill Clinton, and then Obama did the same thing, and by the way, Trump did the same thing, the job has been given to party hacks. Hacks. These are like PR people, marketing people, insiders from the Democratic or the Republican Party. They're not reporters. They're not there to help reporters. They're not there to share information. They're there to feed the media bullcrap, talking points, and prepared, usually untrue statements. Ah, that's what that job has become. I saw it happen in my lifetime. I'm old enough to see how the change came about. It's always bothered me. Which is, well, I know it has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I just had to share that and kind of get it off my chest because that's what it has become. So now, let me go back to her White House statement. So the president's PR lady, that's really what she is, she says the Qataris were told the attack was coming before it happened. Before it happened. Now, common sense, right? Does that make sense to you? Think about that logic. Why, if they knew that they were about to be bombed, did they then still have the meeting? That's like you getting a call that there's a bomb that's about to go off in your house just before you sit down to have dinner with your family, and you say, come on, kids, let's have dinner. Let's try and get it in before the bomb blows us up. What? Right? I mean, I didn't have to go to journalism school to figure this out, right? It's logic. I don't think so. By the way, the Qatari prime minister, he says they were not yet, no, not given a warning. Here.
The attack happened at 3:46. The first call we had from an American official was at 3:56, which is 10 minutes after the attack. Now, when they got the alert, when the alert has reached us, that's an information that I don't know right now. What I know that the official channels that we have with the U.S., got notified by the U.S. after the attack by 10 minutes.
There you have it. 10 minutes after They didn't know ahead of time. You know, in Miami, I was a cop beat reporter for so many years, and I got to know police and how they think, right? And you know, one of the things I learned from hanging around cops all the time and going to bars with them, you know how police usually solve a crime? They look for a suspect who's committed a similar crime in the area, or somebody who has a history, and it's there in their files, somebody who has a history of perpetrating that type of activity. So let me ask you, after saying that, which country has a history of lying and cheating and stealing? I tell you what, I'm not even going to tell you. I'm going to let somebody else give you the answer. Let's ask America's former CIA director. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Michael Pompeo.
I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It's like we had entire training courses.
We lie, we cheat, we steal. Yuck, yuck, yuck. So funny. Applause. If you want to know, by the way, which side the U.S. favors in all of this, here's another video I happened to find when I Googled Mr. Pompeo's name. Here he is doing a little delightful little jig with his buddies in the IDF last year. Got some moves. The Qataris, by the way, are steaming angry about this whole thing. Think about how they got to feel, right? They were literally asked by the United States and Israel to host the negotiations with Hamas. Guaranteed they would not be attacked. They would be taken care of. Everything would be on the up and up. Or I guess that's what they thought. And they truly believed that, I guess. Or that they were led to believe that. That Israel was truly interested in real negotiations. That was obviously their first mistake, the Qataris, that is, believing that. Because some Israeli hardline officials, I can show you, have been on the record saying they're not interested in a negotiated end to this conflict. What they really want is just to get rid of the Palestinians. To show you, it's all over the place in the media. You've heard them say it. Not all Israelis, mind you. But some of the super hardliners say that all the time. Even CNN has reported that. And then there's the mistake of trusting Washington to negotiate fairly. Ask yourself, how'd that go for Iran, right? Look at this headline. This is from back in June. This is an Israeli newspaper I'm reading from, by the way, reporting how the U.S. fooled the Iranians into thinking that they would not be attacked just before they were attacked, right? Israeli-American deception campaign lulled Iran into a false sense of security. Quoting, Israel and the United States carried out a multifaceted misinformation campaign to convince Iran that a strike on its nuclear facilities was not imminent, an Israeli official told the Times of Israel. Quoting again, the official asserted that the U.S. President Donald Trump was an active participant in this ruse. So there you have it. According to the report, my country, the U.S., lied. They gave their word to Iranians that they would continue to negotiate and that there would be no attack. And then they colluded with Israel to do just the opposite, attack. Now, how would Pompeo describe that?
We lied, we cheated, we stole.
Can't get enough of that. The fact of the matter is the United States of America, for all of its other virtues, which there are many, for me and my family, by the way, was built on lying and cheating. How Europeans conquered the Native Americans who were there before them. And as they say, stole their land. Native Americans say that. From 1770, look it up. It's right there. From 1770 to 1870, American European colonizers, they signed 374 treaties with Native Americans. How many did they break or partially break? Every single one of them. Every single one of them. Here, sign this. We give you our word. Psych.
We lied, we cheated, we stole.
You know who else has been fooled by this hidden ball trick? Let me show him to you. This guy. Right here, that you see on your screen. Yeah, see that guy? That's the Soviet Union's last leader, Mikhail Gorbachev.
served from 1985 to 1991, at which point he did a deal with the West. Well, the United States, really. Same thing. The Americans convinced him that they would be his friend. Yes. And not take advantage or expand borders beyond the borders of Germany. Here, let's let Professor Jeffrey Sachs, somebody I respect very much, explain it, as he did recently to a bunch of European leaders.
You will recall that in February 7th, 1991, Hans-Dietrich Genscher and James Baker III spoke with Gorbachev. Genscher gave a press conference afterwards where he explained, NATO will not move eastward. We will not take advantage of the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact.
We will not take advantage of the Warsaw Pact countries and expand NATO, right? That was a lie. Turns out that was just a lie because they, in fact, had every intention of doing just the opposite. Not only did they take advantage of the countries who were part of the Warsaw Pact, they actually started gobbling them up right away, made sure that none of them remained loyal or even was allowed to be friendly with Russia. 16 countries were picked off by NATO just like that. Bang, bang, bang. The Czech Republic, Hungary, then Poland, then Bulgaria, then Estonia, and then Lithuania, and then Romania, and then Slovakia, and then Slovenia, and then Albania and Croatia. And then came Montenegro, another bunch, along with North Macedonia. And finally, they got Finland, and then they got Sweden. They just picked off country after country after country after telling Gorbachev, we would never do that. No, no. We're going to respect, you know, that those countries should be neutral. Not for us, not for you, just in the middle.
Right.
And then they set their sights on Ukraine, right, as we know. And that's when, I guess, finally Russia, you know, put on its big boy pants and said, nope, nope, that's too much. Stop. Not going to let you do it. Not going to let you do it. So what happened in Doha, right? What's going on in Qatar? Here's what we know. Just like the Native Americans, just like Gorbachev, just like the Russians in the 90s, just like the Iranians, it appears that the Qataris and the Hamas negotiators were played. They were fooled. They were hoodwinked. And maybe they should have listened to the immortal words of another famous American, right? Not just Pompeo, maybe somebody bigger. How about somebody like George Walker Bush when he said this?
There's an old saying in Tennessee, I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, we can't get fooled again.
Huh? I think somehow the Qataris maybe get the picture. I want to welcome my guest now because we need to have a serious conversation about this because obviously it's a serious topic, but the world is a little crazy these days. Dr. Mordechai Qadar, he is a Israeli scholar of Arab culture, a retired Israeli military intelligence lieutenant colonel, high rank to say the very least, and he's good enough to join us now. Thank you, sir, for taking time to talk to us.
Pleasure and honor.
Hey, I'm wondering, help me understand how this attack shows that Israel really wants a negotiated solution to this problem with the Palestinians, because what it tells me is they don't want a negotiated solution. And when I say this, of course, I'm talking about the Israeli government. I'm not talking about you, the Israeli people who I adore, or Israel in general.
The Israeli government tries for over 700 days of bloody war to convince the ISIS-named Hamas to leave the Gaza Strip after they destroyed it, to release the hostages, and everything was then, you know, in vain. All the negotiations, what do you expect? That after 705 days, they will start negotiating seriously? These Hamas, ISIS people, they don't want to negotiate. They want to hold the hostages forever in order to squeeze our emotions and to destroy Israel at the end of the day. Don't you know this?
June 22nd, Netanyahu rejected a Hamas proposal to end the war and release more than 100 captives held by the group in exchange for a withdrawal of Israeli forces, the release of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, and recognition of Hamas governance over Gaza. That's Netanyahu being given a deal that Hamas agreed to release the 100 hostages, and he said no. Wait, I have more for you.
Okay, let me tell you.
Okay, go ahead.
The main point in this Hamas offer is that Hamas remain in power in Gaza.
Uh-huh.
Would anyone with a little bit of mind allow such a thing after what they did to us on the 7th of October, 2023, after they burned our children, after they raped our girls, after they killed over 1,000 Israelis? Would you allow such an organization live near in your neighborhood?
Well, I would. If it meant the release of 100 people who I loved and cared for, and this opposition who I don't like for ego reasons or whatever, and this is the guy I have to deal with, I will deal with him because I want those 100 people to be free. I don't want them to die. That's why.
Well, apparently your criteria of how to live are different from our criteria. You know, we are more than sure, and they don't even try to hide it, that if they stay in power in Gaza, the next 7th of October is only a matter of time. So who with the right mind, assuming that you have right mind, allow such a thing?
Here's the thing. The world doesn't believe that Israel is really interested in anything other, based on its actions, than I'll tell you who the world is. And the assertion that I'm making to you, with all due respect, sir, is the following. The Israelis essentially want to get rid of the Palestinians. That's at the root of what they're doing. And negotiating a deal with Hamas or doing anything with Hamas simply gets in the way of that. I've heard that from Smoltrich. I've heard that from Mr. Netanyahu. Here it is. Here's the article. Let me read something to you real quick. Gaza will be entirely destroyed, says the Israeli government minister. Mr. Smoltrich goes on to say, that they will have to leave in great numbers to third countries. The rest, forget about, raising fears of ethnic cleansing in the area. These are government officials. This is not some angry guy in the street who's saying this.
Well, apparently you forgot what happened on October 7th. With the people who attacked us were not only the Hamas fighters, which are actually people from Gaza. Also, old people came, even one with a cane came to rape girls. You know, he still can't do it. Okay, so who would you leave in Gaza after the but and let me ask you, what would Russia did in Chechnya in the 90s because of what happened in Chechnya? How many Chechens were destroyed, killed, murdered? How many women were raped by the Russian army in those days in the 90s? Okay, so a little bit, respect to a nation which wants to live, I would expect from you. However,
Don't get me wrong, and don't play this game with me where you're going to accuse me of being Hamas or something like that, because you know that I'm not, and you know that I think what happened on October 7th was horrible. It was terrible, just like any crime of that magnitude would be terrible.
So would you leave them? Would you leave them?
No, but I would have to.
So this is why we are talking about my friend, what's the problem exactly?
My friend Mordecai, there has to be some level of parity in the reaction. To say that Israel has not gone beyond 100 times what anything that Hamas did on that day would be ludicrous. We are all seeing the pictures of dead children every single day. That's got to hurt you as a father and grandfather. It has to.
Dear Mr. Chances,
yes.
Listen, apparently your memory is not as good as ours.
Okay.
We allowed Hamas to establish a state as of June 2007 when they took Gaza over from the PA.
Encouraged them.
They worked with us.
Yeah.
We allowed thousands of Gazans to come every single day into Israel to work and to bring food home. We supplied them with food, with whatever they needed. What did they do with this? They attacked us. They deceived us. And you know what? Let me tell you something. There was an organization on the way to recuperation. This was the name of the organization here in Israel. It's in Hebrew. And these good people were coming every single day to the Erez crossing to take Gazans to hospitals in Israel to be treated. And they waited for them for free. And they waited for them and they brought them back to Gaza, because otherwise those people would not be able to come to the hospitals in Israel. These good people were the first to be slaughtered. You know why? Because those Gazans knew their names and they knew wherever they where they live, and they invaded their homes and they slaughtered them before anything, before anybody else on October 7th. So what can you say about this?
I'll tell you what I'll say about
how
that.
Can you explain
my,
it?
My dear friend,
should we meet them now?
My dear friend Mordecai, those people you described as Gazans, are they not Israelis?
In Gaza, no.
The people who are living, the Palestinians, are not allowed to consider themselves part of the Israeli experience?
They are not citizens of Israel. They are not residents. They don't even want to be in Israel, and they want to destroy Israel. So what exactly do you ask?
What I'm asking is, these are people who, for many, many decades, felt like they were part of that region. We could go back in history and argue about who the land belongs to, but I don't want to get there, because that's like doing that in America with Native Americans as well. But they feel like they have been put in that place, and they describe it as a concentration camp. They describe it as a place where they have to have permission just to be able to get outside, where they're locked into
you know
that
what,
area.
Mr. Chuck, please stop this nonsense.
Please.
We gave them, listen,
yes.
in the end of the 90s, the Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, gave them in Gaza a gas field for free, which we found and belongs to us. We gave them a gas field, and the company British Gas was ready to send whatever needed in order to make them richer than Dubai.
Yeah.
Okay. What did they do with this? What did they do? They never agreed with the British Gas who will take the money, whether it will be the PA or Hamas. And this is why they don't have gas until this very day. We gave it to them for free, and they could be richer, more like Singapore. And they don't, because they live in jihad. And listen to what they say. I speak Arabic. I believe you don't.
No, I don't.
I listen to them.
I don't.
I listen to them. And you know what? Look at this. This is their flag. This is the flag, the Palestinian flag. And this is the map of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
The whole Israel. So where is Israel, yeah, according to their discourse?
Well,
where exactly is Israel? In the sea, within the sharks.
Yeah.
And you defend them? And this is the plan.
I'm not here to defend anybody. I'm here to call
and
out.
And their mufti.
I'm here to.
And their mufti.
Yes.
Listen.
Yes.
And their mufti, Haj Amir al-Husseini, took part in the extermination of the Jews of Hungary in 1944. He recruited Muslims from Bosnia and Herzegovina to guard the bridges which took the Jews from Budapest to Auschwitz. And this was the participation of the Palestinians in the Holocaust. Apparently, you don't know it.
No, what I do know is, though, that almost every reputable organization in the world that's watching this is saying that Israel is carrying out a deliberate campaign of starvation in the occupied Gaza Strip, systematically destroying the health, well-being, and the social fabric of the Palestinian people, ridding themselves of the Palestinian people. Amnesty International. I could quote so many of them. What do you say to these organizations, my friend Mordecai?
First of all, check who is sponsoring Amnesty International. So they have to cater to those who bring them the money. Secondly, it was proven time and again that was no starvation in Gaza. On the contrary, Hamas are stealing the food and sell it to the Gazans with very high price in order to be able to recruit more people, in order to continue the jihad against us. And apparently you support them. I don't
support them. I'm a journalist, and I'm telling you what the sources are saying, and I'm quoting the sources.
Well, Amnesty International is the least reliable source on whatever happens here, because show me one good thing that Amnesty ever wrote about Israel. Nothing. You will never find.
Then I guess you'd say the same thing about the World Court and the United Nations.
Check who is sponsoring Amnesty. Well, check who is sponsoring.
Okay, both the UN the World Court have said the same thing. What do you say to them?
Politicized to its core. This court is politicized totally against Israel. And just look at the Human Rights Council, which has hundreds of decisions against Israel, nothing against Myanmar, nothing against Russia and its war on Ukraine, nothing on Russia and its war on Chechnya, as it was in the 90s, nothing. All of a sudden, only Israel is the pariah state in the world.
Well,
and you believe this?
I will tell you this. Russia's been at war with Ukraine now for something like 2.5 years. Last time I checked, they've killed...
Russia started the war with Ukraine.
Okay, that's fine. We can argue that later. But let me just give you. Let me just give you some facts. There's about 11,500 civilians who've died in that conflict as a result of what Russia's done. Israel has only been at war, I guess, with the Palestinians for something like a year and a half, if that, and they've already taken out close to 70 to 80,000 people, including 17,000 children.
Did you count?
So
did you count?
I don't have to count. I can look at pictures, sir.
No. Pictures never show you 70,000.
Yes, that's the official.
This figure comes from Hamas.
That's the official count, by the way. Yes, just to answer your question respectfully.
Nobody with official position counted the casualties. All the numbers are coming from Hamas, and they don't make any difference between civilians and fighters of Hamas. We are trying to target the fighters, but they are hiding behind their wives and their children. So what do you want us to do?
Okay. Let me read to you now from folks in Israel who are being very critical of what the Netanyahu government is doing. I'd like to get...
Of course, because of politics.
Well, yeah, but let me get a chance to read it to you, and then you tell me if they're full of crap or not. You
can, I know them.
They're probably friends of yours. Inside. Let me start with this one. Here's a Zionist military analyst, Amir Oren. He writes, even if the assassination...
He writes in Haaretz.
Yes.
He's a good friend of mine. He writes in Haaretz, and he couldn't say one good word about the government.
Even if the assassination, he's still, we're allowed to hear his opinion. So you can knock him down. Let me read it to our audience first. Even if the assassination were successful, it would still be a failure, because a self-respecting state cannot act with such recklessness. Even the Mossad had reservations about this operation. He's talking about what the Netanyahu government just did in Doha. Is he right? Is he wrong? What do you think?
First of all, Israel proved that whoever acts against Israel should bear the consequences. You cannot act against us and sleep peacefully in your bed. Therefore, we attacked Hamas. We attacked Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon. We attacked the Houthis in Yemen, those who are launching missiles against us and actually stopped the traffic, the naval traffic in the Red Sea. Do you have any explanation to this?
No, but these are different cases. You're mixing apples and oranges, and I don't think that's very fair. We're talking about attacking a country who is simply inviting people who seem to be your opposition. The Qataris are not necessarily, you attacked the Qatar, you bombed Qatar, sir. That's very different than attacking the Houthis because they attacked you.
My dear friend.
Okay.
We attacked a building where the Palestinians were in order to target the Palestinians.
But it's not your building, it's not your country, and it does not belong to Hamas. It belongs to Qatar. If every country goes around attacking every other country they're mad at because an enemy of theirs happens to be staying overnight there, we'd be in a hell of a crappy world, wouldn't we?
If there are terrorists like ISIS, don't they deserve to be killed? Are you defending ISIS?
You negotiated with the Qataris to negotiate with them.
How in the world can you then turn around and kill them?
No. And by the way, the Qataris...
What am I missing?
So innocent, according to your presentation, are actually those who sponsored Hamas for many years.
Because you asked them to. Because Netanyahu told them to sponsor them. He literally gave them the green light to back Hamas.
Again, you are mixing between myth and facts.
Okay.
They were smuggling big amounts of money, cash money, through the tunnels from Egypt. And this Netanyahu never told them to do. By the way, the money which Qatar gave Hamas, according to Netanyahu's request, was in order to buy food in Israel. So we actually fed the Gazans, and they attacked us in such a vicious way on October 7th. Again, you tend to forget it. However, Qatar supports Hamas. Qatar supports anti-Semitism all over the world. Qatar supports Islamism in many countries, in Europe and in America. And this Islamism, as you know, is also accompanied by terror as well. And if you have a short memory, I'll remind you about the terror attacks in Europe, which were perpetrated by people who got money from Qatar.
You know what? I grew up in Miami. I probably grew up around more Jews than you. That's how many of my friends that I grew up with in South Florida are Jewish. You know, you've probably been to Miami. It's a great place and a great community. Played basketball with my kids at the JCC, the Jewish Community Center. My quarterback in high school was a Jewish kid. I used to go to his mom's house every day and eat everything that loved Jewish food, by the way. So I've got an affinity as an American for everything that is Jewish. And I love the people. And by the way, I love the food. When I went to Israel, I think it's one of the greatest places to eat in the world. But I'm saddened by that what your government, the government of Netanyahu, I don't know if you claim it or not, is doing, is making the world a really crappy place for my friends. I think the world is going to hold Israel account in many ways, because the world seems to think, and I read this in every country I go to, that Israel is overreaching. Do you not even possibly see the potential for that?
Of course I see. Look, I do go like every other month to speak in all kinds of countries, including Miami. However, here in the Middle East, and you don't live in the Middle East.
No, you're right.
The way to survive in the Middle East is to be strong, to be deterring, and to be dangerous. Otherwise, it is the end of you. Here in the Middle East, only power is appreciated, and deterrence is achieved, as you know, by warning. And when you direct a credible threat to your enemies, they respect you. And this is the Middle East. This is not America here. This is not Europe here. Here is the region where only the powerful, only the brave can survive. We learned it with the years. After all, we came from the Holocaust when we were as far as could be from brave. But in order to survive on our forefathers' land, we have to be strong. And we have to teach our neighbors that if they mess with us, it will be the end of them. And we showed even those in Qatar, yes, in Qatar, the terror-supporting country, yes, the terror-supporting country which is aligned with Iran. Iran is doing it, and Qatar is sponsoring it. This is the difference between these two countries who are in bed with each other. And this is what is happening. And you apparently, since you apparently live in Moscow, as far as could be from the Middle East, I wish that the atmosphere in the Middle East would be like in Moscow. But unfortunately, this is the most miserable area in the world. Look at Libya, look at Sudan, look at Yemen, look at Syria, look at Lebanon. There is not even one normal country in the Middle East apart from the Emirates. And this, in this volcano, which we live in this crater of this volcano, we should survive.
I understand your position, and you defend your position well.
And my job is to challenge
you. Thank you so much.
My job is to challenge you. I feel like, you know, I have arguments like this with my family and my brothers as well. So I hope you don't take it personally. But
No. I thank you for posing these questions and allowing me to answer them, because in many other media outlets, they don't even let answer.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
No, God bless. Thank you so much, Mordecai. And I appreciate your time. And I, like everybody else, wishes that this thing can come to some kind of peaceful resolution.
I also wish.
Soon. Yeah.
We pray for peace. We pray for peace. But, you know, if you want peace, you have to be very, very much prepared for a war.
Let's do this again. Let's do this again. Let's have more conversations. I think that we find solutions when we talk, not when we ignore
Whenever
each other.
Whenever you like, except for Yom Shabbat, I'm with you.
And maybe we'll get together in Miami one day and sit out by the beach and have some coffee or something. Take care, my friend. See you later. Bye-bye.
Good.
What a conversation, right? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to think or what to say, because I almost feel like, you know, I put on my journalism hat every day and I try to ask the right questions and I try to do my research. But so much of this story, so much of what I was just talking about with Mordecai goes beyond journalism in so many ways. It's really about the human experience. A lot of talk about, you know, attacking and hating and these people are bad and these people are good. And I can't help but think that at some point, as a Christian, which happens to be the religion I grew up in as a Catholic, that I learned about love. And I just don't hear that word anymore. What happened to it? What happened about to loving thy neighbor? What happened about looking for solutions through peace and love instead of aggression? Because it almost seems like when I have conversations with either side about these things, it's about aggression, and it's not about love. It's about hate, and it's about war, and, you know, damn it to hell, I almost wish to hell that somehow we can find a way beyond that. And I guess the way we do it is to just ask the hard questions and understand somebody else's perspective. And maybe somewhere in the middle we'll find it, you know? When we come back, I have another segment. I'm going to be joined by Nikolai N. Petro. He's a professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island, place where I almost went to school. And he's an author. And we're going to get into it with him as well about other geopolitical stories going on in the world. We'll be right back. You know, it's hard in many ways to defend any war, but there are comparisons in the world. And there are different types of conflicts that develop. So there's also a conversation about some of the things that were said by my friend Mordecai a while ago regarding the comparison between what's happening in Ukraine and what's happening as well in the Gaza area. So joining us now, Nikolai Petro, professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island, author of Tragedy of Ukraine, What Classical Greek Tragedy Can Teach Us About Conflict. And it is such a pleasure to be able to talk to you. I'm wondering, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to my conversation with Mordecai, but I thought when he tried to draw a comparison between what the Israelis are doing in Gaza and what's happening between Ukraine and Russia, I thought to myself right away, and I didn't want to get into an argument with him about that because it wasn't the right time or the right moment, but there's a real difference, I think, right, between this grudge match between peoples, which is obviously what's happening between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and a borderish type of conflict, which is what is happening between Ukraine and Russia, between two people who do not hate each other, by the way. It's more of a government action. And I think that's the fundamental difference. I'm not for war in any way, and I don't think anybody is. But there is a fundamental difference between these two conflicts. Is there not?
I don't know enough about the Arab-Israeli conflict to make a broad sweeping comparison.
Okay.
I think you have a good point when you say that the people on both sides, Russians and Ukrainians, do not hate each other. As a matter of fact, they've always been close to each other. The word fraternal has in the past, fraternal nations has often come up, been used in the past. But we can't overlook the fact that there are pockets, communities inside, particularly Ukraine, and I'm thinking of Western Ukraine, Galicia, which has a different history from the rest of Ukraine, which was the cradle of Ukrainian nationalism and always thinks of itself as needing to be the definition of what a Ukrainian is, to say, well, what is Ukraine? Ukrainian is someone like us, someone who looks westward, someone who really tries to, our relations with Russia should not be close. As a matter of fact, they should be as distant as possible while recognizing that we're in the same sort of, unfortunately, same linguistic grouping and same area of the world, but we're trying to really push them away as far as possible. Unfortunately, they can only do that so far because the enemy number one, or number two now, but was number one during much of the 20th century, was Poland on the other side. So it leads to a particularly defensive mindset, I would say, on the part of many, not all. I've been to Western Ukraine, to Lvov, Ternopil, and areas in between. But there is a certain distinctive set of cultural assumptions there that make it difficult to get to what you and I would call to get to first base.
Right.
To start to say, why don't you like me? Can't we get along, you know, some way? Can we work this out? Because the primordial assumption on the part of many... Well, many in Western Ukraine is that you can't talk to those people.
Will you give me this, that the situation between the factions in the Middle East is deep-rooted, and those people are in a true grudge match, and they have hated and do hate each other now and will likely hate each other for a long time to come. Frankly, I don't see a reasonable solution there. Switch over to Ukraine and Russia. I see a reasonable solution. I can see a time, I don't know when, I don't have a number for it or a date, when Ukraine and Russia will be able to be either neutrals in terms of their relationship or even maybe even have a relationship once again. I also think, and here's the other differentiator for me, you're the professor. In the case of Ukraine and Russia, external forces are controlling the conflict in many ways, provoking it, causing it, keeping it going, stoking it. In the case of Israel and the Palestinians, they don't need any external forces or any kind of stimuli externally. This is a nucleus of hate that has been there for years, and I think it's going to be there for many, many years. That's how I see it. Maybe I'm full of crap. You tell me.
I disagree because I reflect on the words that you said just a few minutes ago in your previous, at the end of the interview, about love. I would use a different term, which is love expressed in a social context is compassion.
Yes.
Compassion is a word that does have more application in politics than probably love does, because love has been narrowed to self-love, you know, who I love personally, whereas compassion can be, I mean, it's designed to be shared. So the idea, I think, is that I see those two situations that you described as very similar, both in terms of the internal dynamics that have reached a boiling point as well as the external aspects, which let's remember in the case of the Middle East,
yeah,
if my memory serves, this didn't come about overnight. It was also instigated with the help of external forces, the various partitions, the various supports, the various UN resolutions, the ignoring of those real UN resolutions. All of this was part of the external dynamics that fed into the conflict as it has evolved. But the solution to both crises is the same, and it's the solution to every war, which at its kernel, and I would argue this, maybe not everybody does, but that at the heart of every war are both of these things that we were talking about are true. One is there is the magnification of hatred. There is a cultivation of mutual hatreds. Otherwise, a normal peasant, a normal tool worker, okay, is asking themselves, why should I go and kill this person, John, or whatever his name is, Ivan, just because he's far away and I don't feel personally any animosity toward them? And I think that's probably what most people do feel until they're being shot at the front line and they no longer have time to wonder how they got there. But the second aspect, which is also true of every war that I can think of historically, is there are also always external forces ready to take advantage of the situation. Hey, you guys want to go fight? That's fine with me. I'll sell arms to one. I'll sell arms to the other, so long as it's in my interest to do so. And what I'm trying to do is to steer this conflict to the resolution that benefits me, the third party, the one outside of this arena. As a matter of fact, classical British diplomacy in the 19th century and before that, late 18th to 19th century, was all about dividing and conquering Europe. Yes. In other words, not necessarily conquering militarily, but dividing the various powers there so that they couldn't, as the British monarchs feared, gang up and invade the continent.
Yes.
And that was the strategy for generations.
I was actually reading one of your colleagues recently who wrote, interestingly enough, that the British became expert at being in wars and conflicts. They didn't necessarily want to win. They just used them to create what you just said, which is kind of mean-spirited and also brilliant at the same time.
But I have a codicil, if I can, to
please,
that point.
Of course.
And it's sort of what distinguishes my approach from most people who write about this conflict. And it is that at the both of these aspects, the external aspect as well as the internal dynamics of conflict, are important for Ukraine and Russia. But in Ukraine, the underlying, none of this, let me step back a second. The external forces would never have been able to sink their teeth into Ukrainian society to such an extent as to tear it apart if there hadn't been serious divisions from the get-go among Eastern, I'll simplify here, Eastern and Western Ukrainians.
Yeah.
And it is this unresolved internal conflict among Ukrainians themselves over all sorts of things, religion, language, identity, and how they should react to, and who should be their friends outside of Ukraine, and how they should interact with the rest of the world. That's the conflict that needs to be resolved for true social peace to reign within Ukraine. And once that's resolved, they can tell the rest of the world to go take a hike, because that's what a consolidated and united society can do.
There's this report out today, speaking of hate, that I need to get your opinion on. Apparently, Poland is angry at Russia. And it says the reason it's angry is because there were some drones that apparently ended up in their airspace and in part of their area. Doesn't sound like there was any damage or anything significant happened. According to some of the reports that I've seen,
Russia says it and the Ukrainians were engaging in the area. They're not sure whose drones they may have been. But what strikes me as interesting as I read this is, Professor, the reactions from the Polish, as if this were a major conflagration and Russia's getting ready to invade Poland tomorrow or something like that. I may be exaggerating a little bit, but it just seems like there's a lot of anger even in that response. Explain to me, explain to our audience, what's the deal with Poland and its apparent hatred, if I can use that word, of Russia?
There is an historical animosity which is transferred down generation to generation within certain families. In other words, again, there are regional divisions within Poland, but the politics and the historical memory politics of Poland is dominated by an anti-Russian sentiment. And the reason for this, most simply put, is that Russia, of course, along with Prussia and Austro-Hungary, participated in two partitions of Poland that ended the existence of the Polish state. And Poland only came into being at the Versailles Treaty after World War I. And was carved out of portions of all three empires, Russian, Austro-Hungarian, which dissolved, and German Empire. So much historically from that point on of the rationale for Poland's political existence is to maintain that existence against the only remaining empire, which turned out to be the Russian Empire, then transmogrified into the Soviet Union, and now, well, why not? Russia, we'll just throw it in there because it's been our enemy for, you know, since forever. And that's how we get to the situation today. But then add on to it one more thing.
Yeah.
And that is that there is a political struggle between the president and the prime minister.
Huh, in Poland.
One of whom is more pro-EU, and the other is more reluctant to be on the bandwagon. And you'll notice it is the president who says, aha, I always told you so. My anti-Russian policies have proven to be confirmed. And the other side is taking a more wait-and-see attitude. Again, it's only been 24 hours. You know, I'd be interested to ask you a question as a newsman. People often ask me to comment on this or that that happened yesterday or today, even, or 10 minutes ago. Right. And I say, you know, give it a week and we'll know more. And maybe then we'll have the full story. So, you know, cool your jets.
You're
here.
Right.
Let's just think about it a while. And at least if we're going to speculate on what makes sense.
You know, it's
but
funny.
I can tell you that there are at least three versions of this incident now circulated,
of course,
in various media.
Of course.
One is it came from Russia, these drones.
One.
Two, they came from Belarus. Who knows why? And third, and
Ukraine.
This I think was from a source, an anonymous source within the Polish Defense Ministry, that said, no, they actually came from the side of Ukraine.
Right.
Well, again, who knows? Who knows?
Listen, I come from the 24-hour news cycle. I don't know if you've had a chance to read my bio, but I came from local news to CNN, NBC, Fox News. And that 24-hour news cycle drives the new the United States national... Well, you're there. What the hell am I talking to you about? You're in Rhode Island. It's not like you're in Poland. It drives the national conversation. It's ridiculous because stories are done for the sake of just doing the story for one day, and they don't revisit it the next day. And when they have conversations with someone who's got the brilliance that you have and the expertise that you have, they put them on for 3.5 minutes.
Boy,
I'm left thinking, what were you going to learn from this professor in 3.5 minutes to be able to solve? Well, with that said, I do have about 2.5 minutes because we do have to go to another show, but this has been a delightful conversation. Let me just ask you this. Given the situation where it is now, the pressure that is being continually put on by NATO and the EU and the other European countries, although not Hungary, not Slovakia, and given Mr. Trump's reluctance to want to be a player in this thing, and given the fact that Russia seems to be winning this war, how do you see this thing ending up? How do you see this thing turning out?
Probably in a longer, drawn-out struggle, probably not to the actual defeat of Ukraine, mm-hmm. but to the brink of defeat, at which point I think there is a greater likelihood that the political regime, that the leaders of the government in Ukraine will begin to negotiate. I would hasten to point out to people who are watching and may not be following things as meticulously as I am, that negotiations among the parties, Ukrainian official delegates meeting with Russian official delegates, not necessarily at the most senior level, but at some official level to discuss the exchange of bodies, to discuss the mechanics of the exchange of prisoners, to do this or that, to raise all sorts of issues that that have to be resolved short of the end of the, or during the conflict. These negotiations, these meetings have never stopped. And that's important, because what can happen is that messages can be transferred out of the sight of cameras and say, okay, I know you're not going to make the decision on this, but this is a proposal. I want you to push up the chain of command.
Okay.
And ask, you know, and then they'll come down and you can pass it to me and I'll do the same. And this can all be done on the quiet. Okay. So there's a lot of preparatory work that's going on.
You sound very Lavronian.
Well, I mean, that's anyone who knows diplomatic history knows that that's how decisions are actually made. They're not made in front of any cameras.
Right.
They're not made in an instant. They are prepared for weeks and months and years even. Let's think about the Vietnam War. The negotiations that ended the Vietnam War took 3 years. And much of it, much of the first year, as I like to point out, was about the size of the table and whether it was going to be round or square. That's because there was no pressure yet.
You're right. And it's the little things that lead to big things. And that's an excellent point that you have made. And it's the point that I just heard Mr. Lavrov at a news conference he held here not far, I think Moscow State University or something, where he was talking to future diplomats. And he was making that very same point that you were making.
Right.
Hey, listen, we're out of time. Professor, you're a delight. Thank you so much. This has really been a smart conversation, and I think you've left us with a lot of stuff to think about. And our millions and millions of viewers all over the world are going to thank you for that, and I thank you for them. So thank you, sir. Enjoy Rhode Island.
Thank you for having me.
God bless. Take care. And that's it for us. Wow, what an hour. Be still my heart, right? Look, I'm going to take some chunks of some of these conversations and put them on my podcast so you can see them. There's a lot of places where they can't see us, and I think they should. I think this is important and smart stuff. So it's called Journalistically Speaking, JSpeak for short. It's going to be out there soon. Also on X, wow, so many people have been watching and connecting. I mean, I'm seeing hundreds of thousands of people watch these segments, and thanks. I mean, I'm glad you like them. You know, listen, I'm there. I'm connecting with you every day. And let me know what I'm missing. And let me know what I get wrong. What do I know? I try my best, but if I'm doing something wrong, let me know. That's Rick Sanchez TV, by the way. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thanks for being with us, and we'll see you on the next go-round.